From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. On Saturday, Donald Trump thanked Democrats for giving him a nice present on his first anniversary of his presidency. He was talking about this weekend's government shutdown. He is proudly the disruptor in chief. Does he believe a Congress tied up in knots and a country seemingly at war with itself will be good for the country in the end? This hour on Point, where we are after year one of the Trump presidency. You can join us on air or online. How do you grade the president's first year? Is Donald Trump still your guy? Turning Washington upside down, breaking the China, and making change in ways you like? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me this hour from New York City is Bret Stephens, opinion columnist for The New York Times. Bret, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
It's good to be on.
And also in New York City today, Kimberly Atkins, chief Washington reporter and columnist for The Boston Herald. Kimberly, great to have you.
Hi, Jane.
You can find links to Kimberly's and Brett's columns on our website, onpointradio.org. I should say at the top here, depending on when you're listening to this broadcast, our NPR stations will, of course, be updating the very latest from Washington, all the developments on the government shutdown and the votes on Capitol Hill. But as we sit here at this moment, Bret Stephens, what a hot mess. Just another chapter in a year of chaos. How do you see it?
You know, I'm reminded of phrase that was popularized by the late New York Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan. It was defining deviancy down. He was talking about how people become used to certain kinds of reality by simply becoming acculturated to high levels of crime or problematic behavior through constant exposure. And that's the way I see the Trump presidency in its first year. Not at all surprising, given how many of us read his character, his personality, going into the election. So, I mean, I find it just incredible that one of the stories rumbling through the news today from the Wall Street Journal's news side is that the president appears to have had an alleged liaison with a pornographic actress and used an LLC to pay her hush money. And what's striking about this, and what we should, I think, take—I say this as a conservative—sort of pause and consider is the complete comfort that mainstream conservatives seem to have with this story. I'm old enough, in terms of my career, to remember the furor, the conservative furor that went with the Monica Lewinsky saga back then. So one of the things that I find has really changed over the last year is our expectations, at least on the conservative side, our expectations of how a president should behave, of what the culture of governance ought to be. You know, another thing that has just, I find flabbergasting, is the audio message. I don't know how many people have heard it on the White House voicemail, blaming the Democrats for the shutdown and for the reason why the White House can't take your call. So the politicization by the White House of every aspect of government, you can argue, well, it's been a long time in coming, but I think this last year has been a tremendous accelerant for that kind of behavior. And it makes me worried about where we're going to be, not just a year from now, but 20 years from now, in our sense of what a culture of a healthy, small R republic ought to be.
Kimberly Atkins, join in here. And on that thought, this culture of politicization and this divisiveness within the GOP. I mean, you've got Republicans in control of the House, Senate, the White House, and yet here we are.
Yeah, and I think it can't be said enough how unusual it is for a single-party-controlled executive and legislative branch to be in a shutdown. I mean, that's never happened before. And as you point out, it's because not only the severe partisan divide between Democrats and Republicans politically, but also divisions within the GOP caucus itself, divisions between the Congress and the White House. The president is having a difficult time working with both the Republicans and the Democrats there. It just seems that we have gotten to a point that while on the one hand it is extraordinary that a completely Republican-controlled Congress and White House are in a shutdown. On the other hand, it seems like the logical conclusion to where we've been going for years and years. This isn't something that was created by the Trump administration, but it's certainly something that the Trump administration, in its effort to come in and shake things up, as it promised on the campaign trail, has really exacerbated to the point that very little can get done in Washington. And we saw over the weekend, literally, nothing could get done in Washington.
So I want to take a deeper dive into that particular point, how we got to this particular moment. Yesterday on CBS's Face the Nation, House Speaker Paul Ryan blamed Senate Democrats for shutting down the government over an unrelated immigration issue.
Children's health insurance, funding for our troops, keeping the government going, they shut it down over an unrelated immigration issue with a deadline weeks away. And what's so baffling about this was we were negotiating in good faith on DACA all the same. We actually want to solve this problem. So it's not as if we were saying no way, no how, no discussions.
So, Brett Stevens, Democrats didn't want a bill, a funding bill without DACA resolutions. Republicans say, let's pass a budget, deal with DACA separately. There you have Paul Ryan blaming Democrats for blowing up the negotiations. I mean, take us back. Help us dig deep here and understand sort of how we got here. In that televised press conference last week where the president was negotiating with both sides, that seemed like a hopeful moment, right, to many. And then what happened?
Well, it seems like a million years ago, as so often happens. In this administration, one good moment is followed by so many bad ones that it's hard to keep up. Look, I think the Democrats are in a tough position here for the following reason. They're absolutely right, first of all, that we should have a deal on DACA. I think they have very good reasons to fear that a promissory note by the Republicans or by the administration that they will deal with the DACA issue in February, coming very hard on the deadline for the DACA dreamers, is not one that the White House is going to honor. And the reason they fear that is that Donald Trump has never given any indications a year into his presidency that he is capable of negotiating in good faith. Just one final point. The Democrats are playing a very dangerous game for themselves politically because typically Americans hate shutdowns, even if they're for arguably good reasons. And Republicans got hammered in 1995 with the shutdowns. They got hammered again in 2013. If I were a Democrat like Claire McCaskill, Senator from Missouri, I'd be very nervous about the politics of the shutdown.
Hmm. Here is South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham yesterday saying that President Trump was on board for making a deal, but that White House staff, Stephen Miller in particular, are running the show on immigration and essentially making a deal impossible.
Every time we have a proposal, it is only yanked back by staff members. As long as Stephen Miller is in charge of negotiating immigration, we're going nowhere. He's been an outlier for years. There's a deal to be had, DACA plus for more border security funding.
So, Kimberly Atkins, there's Senator Graham suggesting Trump, is in the thrall of extremists on his staff, pulling him back from his more moderate instincts, and specifically Stephen Miller. Is he the puppet master here, Kimberly Atkins?
I don't know that he's the puppet master, but Senator Graham's concerns or the concerns that lawmakers were expressing to me over the weekend as well, that they believe that there is a deal to be had with the president and there is a role, at least up until the beginning of the weekend, there was a role for the president to take in that. And progress was being made, and at the last minute, they would get a rejection of that, usually delivered via White House Chief of Staff John Kelly or Senior Advisor Stephen Miller, sort of like, you know, I equated it to Lucy holding out the ball, and as soon as the lawmakers went to kick, it got yanked back, and they ended up flat on their back. So it's really eroded the trust within the White House. And so I definitely think there's a part there where the president may come to the table, and then he has people in his ear that's urging him to walk it back, perhaps reminding him of the campaign promises that he made. But that being said, these are campaign promises that President Trump made. He talked about the wall. He talked about limiting immigration. He took a very hard line on immigration as part of his campaign. So overall, the White House is delivering on that. I'm reluctant to say that there is some puppet master at play. I think at the end of the day, these are things that Donald Trump campaigned on. And at the end of the day, the buck stops with him.
Donald Trump and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer had a one-on-one meeting at the White House on Friday. Here is Chuck Schumer on Saturday strongly criticizing President Trump's deal-making skills.
Negotiating with this White House is like negotiating with Jell-O. It's next to impossible. As soon as you take one step forward, the hard right forces the president three steps back.
Brett Stevens, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell seemed to agree. I mean, he's been saying the president, I mean, we're spinning our wheels. We don't know where the president stands on a lot of these things. Do they have reason to be confused?
Well, that's exactly it. And, you know, even at that meeting you mentioned earlier where the president was making an appearance of statesmanship and sanity, he seemed to be confused about basic things like what exactly is entailed by a clean bill. So the president either doesn't know his mind or is just simply so enamored with keeping everyone off balance that he himself has lost the plot. But this is, you know, I mean, obviously there's a danger in a kind of a nostalgia that pretends that we didn't have crashing disagreements between parties in the past, between the branches. But there was once Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan. Now we have this, and that marks the decline of American politics.
Hey, it's Ophira Eisenberg, host of Ask Me Another. We headed out to L.A. for two all-celebrity contestant shows, and the competition was more intense than the traffic on the 405. Linda Cardellini, Jeff Garland, Lance Reddick, and Paul Rust. Only one took home an Ask Me Another Rubik's Cube. Find Ask Me Another on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. After 1 year of an extraordinary presidency, some call it a breath of fresh air. Others say it's dangerous. We are taking stock this hour. So much has happened, and we want to know what the key moments were for you. Firing James Comey, swearing in Justice Gorsuch, Trump on the Charlottesville clashes, the Russia investigation, the border wall. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. A really terrific panel this hour. My guest, Brett Stevens, opinion columnist for The New York Times, and Kimberly Atkins, chief Washington reporter and columnist for The Boston Herald. I want to play this from Saturday, President Trump's official reelection campaign, releasing a provocative new ad claiming that Democrats are complicit in murders committed by undocumented immigrants. Here's the ad.
President Trump is right. Build the wall. Deport criminals. Stop illegal immigration now. Democrats who stand in our way will be complicit in every murder committed by illegal immigrants.
Brett Stevens, House Speaker Paul Ryan said the ad was not, quote, productive. Your thoughts about this?
I think the ad is vile. And calling it not productive has become the classic Paul Ryan cop-out and the cop-out of many Republicans and conservatives who have allowed themselves to become co-opted by a kind of a nativist species of far-right populist conservatism, which I think is unrecognizable, would have been unrecognizable to the party of Reagan or past Republican presidents. And this is a real problem that conservatives have, which is that I think a lot of conservatives thought that Donald Trump was an empty vessel into which they could pour sort of standard Republican wine, if you will. The truth is that it's the Donald Trump that is pouring himself and his kind of instincts and bigotries into mainstream conservatism. He's corrupted them rather than having them influence him. And I think that's dangerous. You know, wherever someone stands politically, listeners of the show who are on the left probably, I'm sure, understand that much as they disagree, you need a healthy center-right party. One of the things that I find so distressing about Trump's presidency is that he doesn't have, he's creating a kind of a diseased right-wing party, and it's diseased most of all by anti-immigrant xenophobia. You saw that in Jeff Sessions' extraordinary comments the other day, suggesting, you know, why do we need these sort of poor, illiterate people coming to our shores? It's as if the man has never given a thought to what the Statue of Liberty represents and where at least my ancestors were a century or so ago in terms of poverty and in terms of skills. I think this is extremely damaging, and it shows that the Republican Party is moving more closely in the direction of, say, the National Front in France or other populist right-wing movements than a kind right of center, libertarian leading Republican Party, which is what I would like to see.
Let me get a listener in here. Chris in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Chris. Glad you called. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for speaking with me.
Yes.
I voted for Obama twice, the re-election, and I voted for Donald Trump during the past election. And I just think it's a, you know, Donald Trump's election was a referendum on immigration and foreign policy, and just the general divisions we saw that were being started in the end of the Obama administration with the police shootings and such.
Mm-hmm. What about where we are right now, Chris? Do you blame Donald Trump in any way for the government shutdown, sort of where we find ourselves at this moment?
Not at all. It's both sides, and I think it's really kind of sad when, you know, your guest describes people like me as, you know, the hard right and describes how he wishes Republicans should be. It's just strange.
Chris, thank you very much for the call. Kimberly Atkins, I mean, I guess regardless of where anybody places blame for where we are in this moment, President Trump did make specific promises about fixing the kind of dysfunction that we're seeing right now. He called himself the master negotiator, said he was going to fix Washington. What is the accurate way to think about the president's role in all this?
Yeah, I mean, I think especially when it comes to being a negotiator, I think what we've actually seen play out is the president has taken a fairly limited role when it comes to the actual crafting and negotiation of the kinds of legislation that he promised. I mean, we saw that first with the efforts, the repeated efforts to repeal and replace Obamacare. He really wasn't involved. He sort of served as an outside cheerleader for the effort and would bring lawmakers together and for the most part would tell them to work it out. We saw him actually do that in real time on the issue of immigration, bringing people together a couple weeks ago and saying, you figure it out and I'll just sign it. And that sort of goes against this idea that he is a master negotiator. And that's one reason why lawmakers on both sides at this point aren't entirely sure what the president wants and what the president might sign in an immigration bill. But on the flip side, he's also prone to sort of throw wrenches into the process as well with his Twitter feed. We saw him send out a tweet not really understanding what the chip provision in the bill was and sort of having lawmakers have to tell him what that was. We saw him send out a tweet when it came to the FISA 702 renegotiation, seeming that he didn't really understand that either. So, I mean, lawmakers tell me, including Republicans, tell me that they don't necessarily want him involved in the crafting of legislation. And all this cuts against his claim to be this great deal maker and that that's what Washington needed. Perhaps it is, but he's not serving that role.
Well, let's hear from him on that point. Flashback 2013, here is Citizen Trump publicly blaming President Obama for the government shutdown in that year, 2013. Here is Donald Trump on Fox and Friends taking a jab at Obama's leadership.
You say, who gets fired? It always has to be the top. I mean, problems start from the top, and they have to get solved from the top, and the president's the leader. And he's got to get everybody in a room, and he's got to lead. And he doesn't do that. He doesn't like doing that. That's not his strength. And that's why you have this horrible situation going on in Washington. It's a very, very bad thing, and it's very embarrassing.
Brett Stevens.
I think anyone who followed Trump's career in business from the 1980s on understands that he played a master negotiator on TV. he wasn't a master negotiator in real life. And I mean, people point to the fact that Trump also endlessly reprimanded President Obama over his golf outings. I mean, golf is mysterious to me, but it's quite something to see the frequency with which Trump has taken to the game as president. The central promise of the Trump presidency was that he was a disruptor in a positive sense, but that he was also a conciliator, a negotiator, and someone who could get things done. And I think taking stock at least a year into the presidency, the conclusion is that was the central false promise of his presidency, because it's difficult to remember a moment when Washington has been as dysfunctional, and Lord knows there have been plenty of dysfunctional moments in the city's history, but nothing quite approaches this sort of circus. And Trump, as the ringleader, as the leader, deserves the lion's share of the blame for that.
Let's get Kevin in here from Monroe, North Carolina. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Jane. My comment is that the Democrats should keep the government shut down until they get everything they want. Mr. Trump and his administration have been attacking everyone ever since they've been in office. And it's time to stand at ground. Don't give up. Don't give out. Don't give in.
All right. Democrats should hold out. Okay, Kevin, we've got it. A lot of our listeners say Trump has actually done a great job so far in office. John says Trump's accomplishments in his first year are nothing short of amazing, but consider the fact that he's accomplished so much while fighting off the deep state, fake news, and the mainstream media. Others, not so much. Here's KG, who says he gets an F. It should be an F minus, actually, but I'm being optimistic. I mean, one more last point on this, Kimberly Atkins. What are the political consequences of this shutdown, do you think?
I think it's tough to know. I mean, I think immediately it's going to reflect poorly on everyone. I don't think that there's any winners coming out of a government shutdown. When the government stops working, it's sort of at least a little bit of a pox on all your houses, according to public sentiment. But I think, on the other hand, you do have people on the Democratic side, such as Kevin, who just called, who I think Democrats enjoy broader support right now for their efforts to sort of hold the line and force Republicans to come to the table, then Republicans necessarily will coming out of it. I think that Brett is absolutely right that there are some conservatives in or Democrats in red states that could suffer the most. But I think for the most part, it's going to be negative all the way around, maybe less so for Democrats. But I mean, it's January. People are wondering what this means in an election year. We have midterms coming up in November. But given the news cycle and how many things have come up just in the last couple of weeks, or the fact that we've had, you know, a porn star come out and say she had an affair with the president and nobody's paying attention. I don't know what, if any, effect the shutdown will have ultimately on midterms. I just think too many things can happen between now and November to know what it means then. People may have forgotten about it altogether.
Let's get to Leo here in Akron, Ohio. Hi, Leo. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I don't know where to begin. I mean, this has been a year of just gross incompetence and international embarrassment. I mean, anybody that paid attention to this campaign knew that this man had no core convictions, he was easily swayed, and comically uninformed. All you have to do is look at all the credit he's trying to take for the economy right now, the economy that he inherited. Okay? The numbers that he used to mock as fake and phony are now somehow legitimate. There's never been any mention of his predecessor and his administration and their efforts to rescue us from a near depression. Okay? Nothing at all.
Leo, thank you. You know, we should get to this, Brett Stevens. I mean, in many ways, it is a tale of two presidencies. We've got this economy booming, record-breaking stock market, unemployment down. Is it still the economy stupid? I mean, should a president with an economy this good have higher approval ratings?
Well, I think it is. I mean, my view is that the wealth factor typically trumps the yuck factor, and I think Democrats like the man who just called in. I don't know if he's a Democrat, but people like the man who just called in are making a mistake in supposing that moral outrage and a general sense of distaste with the chaos in Washington or with the president's tweeting will really harm the president if you do have this Goldilocks economy. Look, you know, back in 1993, Bill Clinton started taking credit for an economy that we now know had really begun to recover under the George H.W. Bush presidency. Americans don't care. Americans will say whoever's presiding over the economy is going to get the credit. And I think Democrats, if they're smart, need to recalibrate their opposition to the presidency. I mean, a lot of people will, in fact, benefit from the tax bill. Apple just announced that it was repatriating huge amounts of earnings overseas. You can argue some of the details, but it's Democrats don't want to be the people who are looking for the cloud in that silver lining. That doesn't play well for them politically. Now, you have to tone down the opposition so that not everything that this administration does is, Hitlerian or atrocious and so on, and also find an affirmative message of how Democrats intend to govern differently other than to provide a measure of sort of sanity and balance that the White House lacks.
Kimberly, do you agree with our caller, Leo, who says, you know, Donald Trump inherited this economy, or do you see it the opposite perspective? I mean, do the markets like Trump's tax bill, for example, his deregulation? I mean, where do we fall here?
Yeah, I think it can be both. I think both things can be true. I think the markets do like some of the policies that the president has put forward, and that is helping to keep the economy on the upward trajectory that it has been on since roughly 2010. If you look at all indicators, look, it's not unusual for a new president to take credit for or blame previous administrations for what's going on. The Obama administration, for the entirety of the administration, blamed the Bush era for the recession, and with good reason. And we talked about what's happened in previous years, so that isn't so unusual. Especially, and also given that President Trump is the economic guy. I mean, he's the businessman who said he was going to come in and run the country like a business. Of course, he's going to take credit for that. I don't think that is so unusual. But I do agree with Brett wholeheartedly that the Democrats need to talk about this differently. And there are things that the Democrats can say about the tax bill without just attacking it, especially if people are seeing benefits from it. They held the line to make sure that a lot of the provisions that were in the original bill were so unpopular that they were taken out. A lot of the key deductions that were going to be eliminated were not. I mean, talking about how school teachers would not be able to deduct pencils yet, big execs would be able to deduct their golf club memberships. That worked, and those provisions were changed. So I think there is a way to talk about it and be a pro-economy party and move forward. And I think that's something that they need to do.
Here are Republican lawmakers joining President Trump in December to celebrate the passage of the GOP's tax plan. Here's House Speaker Paul Ryan at that celebration ceremony.
The message to the families in America who've been struggling paycheck and paycheck, your tax rates are going down and your paychecks are going up. This is the kind of relief that Americans deserve.
Brett Stevens, certainly a signature piece of legislation to date for the president.
Yeah, probably the single most important thing he may do as president. And I have my quarrels with the tax bill. My quarrels actually come from, I guess, the right, in that I didn't think it cut taxes deeply enough. But I suspect it is true that a majority of Americans are going to find that Paul Ryan's prediction is broadly right. So Democrats have to take account of that fact. You know, what worries me most is when people start talking about the deep state and fake news. Really, that's a kind of a slur about the United States government and the people who serve it. And that's what we really ought to be talking about, the degradation of culture in Trump's America.
Ever get to Friday, look back on the week, and say to yourself, what just happened? I'm Sam Sanders. Check out my podcast, It's Been a Minute, where every Friday we catch up on the news and the culture of the week. and try to make sense of it all. Listen on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. Listeners, it's been 1 year since Donald Trump became president. How is this administration handling our foreign relations, our national security? And at home, has the president brought us together at all or divided us further? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Great panel today. My guest, Kimberly Atkins, chief Washington reporter and columnist for the Boston Herald, and Brett Stevens, opinion columnist for the New York Times. Want to play some sound here. This is Friday. President Trump touting the surging economy during his first year in office.
Our country is doing really well. Our economy is perhaps the best it's ever been. You look at the job numbers, you look at the companies pouring back into our country, you look at the stock market at an all-time high, unemployment 17-year low.
A lot of listener response to this hour. Alex says, the biggest trend I'm seeing is the decline of the U.S. as a major player in anything at all on the world stage. Apparently, America first means America alone. Ed says, so little truth coming out of the White House that Americans now pretty much ignore much of everything that's being said by Trump or his advisors. We're so saturated by Trump tweets that we miss a lot of significant events that should be covered. Another listener says, you can talk about all sorts of things, but ultimately I think our retreat from environmental stewardship will be Trump's principal legacy. Let's get Andrew in here from Rome, Georgia. Hi, Andrew. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
You bet. Go ahead.
I can concede that Trump hasn't done all bad. You know, I think that's an okay thing to say. But the types of accomplishments that he's being championed for, really not even just that they aren't his, like the economy, but the tax bill wasn't passed until late, very, very late last year, and the economy had been going up. And I'm not attributing that to just Obama, although I'm sure his administration, of course, had a hand in it.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think you can throw in consumer confidence being up just to something that he did, especially with the tax bill being so late. You know, we saw significant growth before it was passed,
mm-hmm.
and while it was talked about behind closed doors, and things were going up before people even knew what was in it.
I get it. Andrew, thank you. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to John in East Hampton, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air. What are your thoughts?
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I also would like to comment on the economy, and I don't think it's actually doing that well. I have two children in their mid-20s. They have huge student debt. Unless they're in high tech, it's very difficult to get a job. Moving on to graduate school is going to be very difficult for them. There are huge disparities between the rich and the poor in this country that it's getting only worse. That's not a great economy.
Mm-hmm.
There are huge poverty pockets all across the rural part of the country, and there's tremendous despair amongst young people. I think that's the source of the opioid crisis, despair. They're looking at huge debt, difficult to get an education, in a collapsing planet.
Hmm.
And
John,
nobody's paying attention to the real problems.
John, thank you. A lot of our listeners agree with you on those particular points. Brett Stevens, I want to go back to something you mentioned right before the break, where you talked about your concerns about Donald Trump and his comments about fake news, about the deep state, and generally the degradation of the social conversation. Can you speak more to that?
Well, look, you know, when you talk about fake news, the administration came out with a top 10 list of its so-called fake news awards. I looked through the list and I couldn't find a single example of fake news. On the other hand, the number of times this administration has deliberately and almost certainly knowingly misled the American people from, you know, the location of carriers in the Pacific long list of subjects. It's kind of staggering. But you're creating a climate that is reminiscent of dictatorships. And, you know, it reminds me of Erdogan's Turkey, of just profound hostility to the media, which is the news media, which is, at the end of the day, just about the most important prop for American liberties or for liberties anywhere that you can find. When you talk about a deep state, there is no deep state. the allegation that, you know, the FBI agent who lives across the block from you is somehow a member of a conspiratorial deep state is a slander. And so it creates a kind of a climate in which people think that their government is somehow conspiring against them, which is particularly ironic given that Donald Trump is the president and he administers the Justice Department and FBI and CIA and all the other alleged organs of that state. So this has a kind of, I think, insidious effect on the way people think. It has an insidious effect on their ability to have social trust, to trust a set of facts that we can all objectively agree on. One of the things that I've just found so distressing over the past 2 years or so is the extent to which Americans can't simply agree on a common set of facts. And I think ultimately that's really very, very destructive. I just want to make one quick point, Jane, if I may, about one of your callers, John from I think Massachusetts. You know, as he was speaking about the opioid crisis and the fact that the economy really isn't that good, I was trying to puzzle in my mind whether he was a supporter of the president or an opponent of him. And I think we need to be aware that even as some of us really don't like much of what the president has done or is doing, he is touching on themes of a sense of decline and social crisis that are real and weren't being addressed previously. I don't think they're being addressed now either.
We're talking about President Trump's 1 year in office as this weekend marked that anniversary. I want to talk about his travel ban. Here is President Trump announcing his first travel ban of his presidency in January of last year. The executive order barred citizens from 7 majority Muslim countries from entering the United States for 90 days.
I'm establishing new vetting measures to keep radical Islamic terrorists out of the United States of America. We don't want them here. We want to ensure that we are not admitting into our country the very threats our soldiers are fighting overseas.
Kimberly Atkins, remind us what happened with those travel bans and generally these new restrictions that President Trump has placed on immigrants and the executive orders that have been blocked by the courts.
Yeah, so they were met with an immediate, well, there have been 3 iterations now of this travel ban. The first one was put into place with very little notice to the federal agencies and caused all kinds of chaos at the airports. It was halted by the courts, and every other iteration has faced challenges as well and have been, for the most part, halted until the most recent one that the U.S. Supreme Court has allowed to mostly go into effect. So there is a travel ban in effect at the moment, but the Supreme Court has agreed to hear that case in full this term, one of the many big cases that will be coming out around June out of the U.S. Supreme Court. But it is one of many edicts that the president has put forth that have not only met a lot of opposition in court and have been tied up in court, but that kind of goes back to what I think has been a central theme in his presidency, which is fanning the flames of cultural wars. I think he enjoys doing that. A lot of these cultural wars have very deep undertones, or maybe not even undertones, sometimes overt overtones that are racial overtones, gender, and xenophobia and anti-religious orders, which is what courts have been holding up this travel ban on, saying that based on his own tweets, based on his own statements on the campaign trail, that this is really about religious animus. And we've seen that with his, you know, inexplicable ban on transgender troops, a solution that was want for a problem, and a lot of other things in this presidency, from his, you know, tweets about the NFL protests of racial violence against people of color by police. He sort of fans these things, and it seems to him seems to be a win. It seems to be popular among his base, but at the same time, it's really eroding widening the divide, the racial, gender, and religious divisions within this country, and really lowering the state of discourse in this country. I mean, I can attest as a journalist of color, especially given the animosity toward mainstream news, the fake news, etc., just the vile comments that I get in my inbox or tweeted to me on a daily basis is something that I have never seen before, not at this level. And that is something that is coming from the top, that is coming from the discourse that the president is setting himself. So that's I think that's a major and very disappointing part of this administration.
Let me get Jeffrey in here from Waynesville, North Carolina. Hi, Jeffrey. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Let me first of all state up front, I am not a Trump supporter. My comments are going to sound that way, but I'm not. But having said that, I think our focus on the president in the last 12 months and so forth is shortchanging the American public as a topic of our focus. The reality is he's our president. We elected him, or at least the Electoral College did. I think he's the third or fourth president in our history who got to office with the minority of the public vote. Having said all of that, we are not taking enough responsibility for what we did. And I hope that what Trump is providing for us is a lesson that we can learn by, and that is, how did we manage to elect this kind of a person in the first place? We knew full well, I mean, all the warning signs were there. There was nothing particularly hidden about him.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we put him in as our president.
So I got it, Jeffrey. Thank you. And our time is short. I do appreciate your call, and I hear what you're saying. I want to get another listener in here, Lisa from Hinsdale, New Hampshire. Lisa, you're on the air. Welcome. Lisa, are you there? Peter is in Boston. Peter, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome to the program.
Yeah, you know, listen, let me just preface my remarks. I did vote for Trump. I have a lot of problems of how he has acted. However, that being said, I absolutely have no regret. If Hillary would have been another Obama continuation, would have been open borders, as bad as the borders are now when you're trying to do something, you would have had open borders. Secondly, Obama and Ashton Carter were concerned with the military, with political correctness of gays and transgendered, how to integrate them in the military, nothing about effectiveness of war fighting.
Mm-hmm.
When you're thinking about transgender, let's think about Bradley Manning and what a great boon that was to have him in the military, and then he got commuted.
All right, Peter, thank you. Thank you very much. I just want to get the wall in here, Brett Stevens, because it's been a big issue. The immigration issues have been quite divisive in the last few months, over the last year, in fact. President Trump promised that Mexico would pay for the wall. Mexico says it's not going to pay for the wall. Then you've got White House Chief of Staff John Kelly telling lawmakers last week that some of the president's hardline immigration policies were, quote, uninformed. Talk about all this in the context of how the president's positions have changed, how they have evolved over the past year.
I don't know if they have evolved. I wish they had. I mean, one of the things that I find striking is the amount of demagoguery about immigration in the United States. Illegal immigrants are incarcerated at roughly half the rate as native-born Americans. Legal immigrants are incarcerated at about one-third of the rate. Immigrants, whether they're legal or illegal, are some of our most law-abiding citizens for reasons that, if you stop to think about it, should be obvious. They're here for opportunity, not here for criminality. And there's a tone in this country that somehow suggests that our fundamental security concern is terrorists coming over the border from Mexico. As far as I know, only one terrorist that we know of ever came over a land border into the United States, and he came over the border from Canada, the so-called Millennium attack. Nobody talks about building a wall with Canada. So there's a kind of a level of disinformation and misunderstandings about immigration, which are damaging to the fabric of this country. You know, your last caller talked about Bradley Manning and holding him up as an example of, you know, why we shouldn't have transgender people in the military. Lord knows that if you look at any single group across the board, you can find one bad apple. But that's certainly no excuse ever to suggest that a whole category of people ought to be discriminated against. And I used to think that Americans, Republicans or Democrats, liberals or conservatives, generally understood this. I think this is one of the real transformations that has taken place under the Trump presidency. You'd have to go back to the 1920s to find a similar transformation. And it was not a good period for the United States. I think, you know, I have a personal bias in this. I'm an American citizen who grew up in Mexico. And I think that Americans should wake up every day and count their blessings that we have Mexico as a neighbor. You know, Poland has Russia as a neighbor. South Korea has North Korea as a neighbor. We have a wonderful neighbor to our south. And demonizing them and demagoguing the issue and suggesting that Mexicans coming over our border simply to do jobs and find a better life for themselves are potential terrorists is one of the ugliest things that I've seen happen over the last couple of years. I wish more right-of-center people like me would take up the cause of supporting America as a country that loves its immigrants, because we know from our own experience how much we've benefited from them.
Kimberly Atkins, about a minute left here. Do you think Donald Trump has transformed the Democratic Party into sort of more left-leaning, more activist party?
Well, I certainly think that the left-leaning aspect of that party has been more energized by the Trump presidency. I think that whoever we see come out as candidates in 2020 will likely be far to the left than we have seen in the past. But I think that the Democrats, we talk a lot about the Republicans right now because they're in power, but I think there are still divisions within the Democratic Party that they're going to have to work out. I think that's one reason why their message has not been as strong as I think that it ought to be if they want to compete in 2018 and 2020. We'll have to see how they flesh that out themselves.
I've got 10 seconds. I want you each to give Donald Trump a grade for this year. Kimberly Atkins, A through F, what's your grade?
I think I'll have to say incomplete.
Brett Stevens?
A D.
A D. Well, it's been great to have you both help us clear the air, get a clear picture of this president 1 year in. Brett Stevens, opinion columnist for The New York Times. So great to have you, Brett. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Kimberly Atkins, chief Washington reporter and columnist for The Boston Herald. Great to have you with us as well, Kimberly.
Thanks for having me.
Continue the conversation, listeners. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.